Next case in our calendar is 96-1929, State of Ohio versus Nathaniel Gibson. Mr. Elkins.
May it please the court, my name is Arthur Elkins. I am here on behalf of the State of Ohio, the appellant in this case. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes, if I could, for rebuttal. Thank you. Quite simply, the issue before this court this morning is, when does a trial court abuse its discretion in finding that a defendant is not indigent for purposes of the mandatory fine in 29-2503H? The legislature has adopted a policy, a public policy, that states under certain circumstances, when individuals violate sections of the drug law, that they subject themselves to a mandatory fine. The statute provides that there is an exception to that mandatory fine. That exception occurs if an individual is indigent. In order to determine whether or not an individual is indigent, two steps have to occur. The first step, the defendant must file an affidavit of indigency prior to sentencing. The second step, the court must conduct a hearing and determine that the individual is unable to pay the fine. The district courts throughout Ohio are all over the place, quite frankly, on both of these two tests in terms of indigency. Some of the district courts have held that the filing of an affidavit prior to sentencing does not quite deprive the court of jurisdiction, but it's just one standard that the court can look at to determine whether or not it wants to find an individual indigent.
Is the finding or the issue of indigency a matter of fact or law?
Your Honor, I would say actually it's a mixed question of fact and law under the circumstances here.
Well, then shouldn't we defer to the trial court?
I think under the circumstances, for the most part, if I may, can I answer your question this way? The reason that I say that it's a mixed issue of fact and law, under the first requirement of the statute, an affidavit must be filed prior to sentencing. The language is mandatory.
The affidavit must be what?
The affidavit must be filed.
Filed. Oh. Filed. How do we get it filed?
Well, that's
by time stamping it, right?
Absolutely.
I got it.
Absolutely.
Okay. Absolutely.
Absolutely. And Your Honor, that pretty much gets right into my issue in terms of a matter of law. All of the courts, at least the cases that I've read, none of the courts have really addressed the issue straightforward on whether or not the affidavit was filed. In most cases, the affidavit, in real life, what happens is that on the day of sentencing, someone steps up, hands the trial judge an affidavit, and it's submitted. It's not really filed. My point is that in this case, very similar to the issue that this court has decided in Pless, that affidavit must be filed. As you've stated in Pless, the determination is, what does filing mean? Filing means that it must be submitted to the clerk of courts, and there must be a timestamp. That's an issue.
It was your colleague that just argued before us, wasn't it?
Well,
I want to be sure I've got the players straight.
Of course, that the issue there is a different issue than
we're
dealing with here.
This is a different case.
This is a different case,
yeah.
Of course. So as a matter of law, the question is, does the court have jurisdiction if the affidavit is not filed properly? The question should be answered no. In the negative, the court does not have jurisdiction. Secondly, the issue is whether or not the court, it's a matter of fact. Well, that goes to the second component of the test. The court must determine whether or not, and this, of course, is on the record, whether or not the defendant is not unable to pay the fine. Now, there is a difference between being able to pay the fine and being not unable to pay the fine. The burden of proof in a situation like this is on the defendant to present evidence of his inability to pay the fine.
But didn't he do that in this case?
In this case, really, all the defendant did was put forth in front of the court an affidavit, which was not properly filed.
The court considered the issue, correct?
The court considered the issue, correct.
You didn't object, did you?
The court, no, we didn't object to the issue being considered?
Yes, by the court.
No, absolutely not. We did not object.
Well, it's unopposed. I'm sorry.
Don't you know that it has to be filed before the court can consider it?
Well, again, can you waive a jurisdictional issue? I think that's the question. In this particular case, the fact that we didn't bring it up does not mean that we waived it. This is a jurisdictional issue that we could not waive.
You just missed it, is that it?
Your Honor, since I wasn't there, I can't tell you what the facts were of the case. However, I would assume, since the record is silent, we must have just missed it. But again, it's a jurisdictional issue that we cannot waive.
But the court did have a hearing. He made a determination, didn't he, now?
That's correct. The court had a hearing, made the determination that the defendant was not unable to pay the fine.
So as you agreed with Justice Douglas, that it's part law and part fact, and the court made a finding, didn't he not?
The court made a finding that the defendant was not unable to pay the fine. That's
so
correct.
So shouldn't we stick with that finding, since the state didn't object to the court even entertaining this?
That's
this
our
issue?
Argument exactly, is that the Court of Appeals erred in finding contrary to that, and that this court should reverse. Not only that, but let's look at the facts that the court looked at or had before to make that determination. What we have here is where we had an individual who was originally assigned the public defender to represent him. Now, somewhere, for whatever reason, this individual decided to retain counsel on his own. The same counsel that's representing him today here at appeal is the counsel that represented him at this hearing. Now, it's not dispositive that the fact that he retained counsel, it's not dispositive of the fact of whether or not he's indigent, but it's one factor that the court can use to make that consideration. The court also found that this was an individual that was 19 years old. He was able-bodied. There was no indication that he suffered from any physical, mental, or emotional disabilities. So this was an individual that could pay the fine. Not only that, but most of the cases, all of the cases that were cited by the 8th District in terms of the mere possibility, the use of mere possibility to be able to pay a fine to be determinative of the person's energy status, doesn't apply here. In this case, this individual was not incarcerated. He was placed on 4 years probation, so he had every opportunity to pay the fine.
That was going to be my other question, the more serious question, because in that colloquy between the trial court, the judge, and the Mr. Mancino, trial court, as I recall it, having read it, and I don't have it in front of me, but the trial court said something, well, maybe he's indigent now, but he's going to be on probation for 4 years, so therefore he maybe will be able to pay it during that four-year period. My question is, if you file an affidavit of indigency, is it effective now, or can we say, maybe you're indigent now, but you might not be sometime in the future? And doesn't that beg the question?
It does beg the question, but again, under the facts in this particular case, if we had an individual that was going to be incarcerated with no obvious means of being able to pay the fine, then I think the issue would be different and it would be decided different. We don't have the facts. That's not the facts in this case.
Did the judge in this case also say that if at the end of the 4 years you don't have the means with which to pay the fine is suspended?
Well, I believe that was not on the record. I believe that particular reference occurred in the state's brief, in the state's appellate brief.
So that's not
a record. It's not an issue that should be decided by this court.
Mr. Elkins, I'd like to move back to the issue of the filing and whether or not that's the timeliness of that, of filing the affidavit, whether or not that's jurisdictional. Did the state raise the issue of arguing this jurisdictional issue in the Court of Appeals?
No, the state did not raise that issue. Actually, what the state did is that it adopted the dissent in total as the argument in its brief. At
this court,
right.
Yeah, I mean, because the Court of Appeals does not discuss, the majority of the Court of Appeals does not discuss the issue of the filed.
Right, exactly.
And yet it is raised in the dissent. But
exactly.
That raises with me the question of whether or not the state made that an assignment of error in the Court of Appeals.
Well, the fact that the state adopted.
No, you need to answer that yes or no.
Okay.
Did they or did they not?
Well, no, the state did not.
And is that a waiver of that issue?
No, I would argue that it's not. A jurisdictional issue can be raised at any time for the first time on appeal, and I would argue that it can be raised for the first time in front of this court on appeal.
Okay.
Counsel, if I understand, your test for indigency would be sort of a rolling test. If at any time during this probation period he has means, then the imposition of a fine is, instead of a snapshot at the hearing, it's a window of time.
Well,
is that the test?
Not exactly. The standard of review here is whether or not the court abused its discretion. That standard, in essence, means was the court's decision arbitrary, capricious, or unreasonable? Under the circumstances here, the trier of fact is in the best position to make that determination. So based on the facts before it, the court has to make the determination whether or not the individual is unable to make the fine. That's going to be fact specific. It's going to be case specific. It doesn't have to be a rolling, you know, sort of determination. Under the facts in this case, the trial court was not unreasonable, was not capricious, and was not arbitrary. Made a rational determination that the individual was not unable to make the fine. I see that my time is running low, and I want to reserve some time for Mr. Sadd.
Thank you, Mr. Elkins.
Thank you.
Mr. Sadd, you're going to take rebuttal?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Mr. Mancino.
May it please the court, Paul Mancino on behalf of the appellee, Nathaniel Gibson, Your Honors. In this case, and I think Mr. Elkins has tried to expand the issue before this court concerning whether this affidavit was or was not filed in accordance with the statute. There was no claim in this case at no point in the proceedings concerning whether this complied with the statute concerning the filing.
It is a subject of the dissenting opinion that the failure to have filed.
Well, only in passing, in the sense that the courts stated that there was no question that it was handed to the court at the time of sentencing, the court did not accept it at that particular point. But I think the statute, all the statute requires is filing with the court. That's physically handing it to
that?
The
court. What would make you say that, Mr. Mancino, when the statute uses the word filed?
It says filed with the court, though it doesn't say filed with the clerk. Doesn't say filed and made part of the record or anything.
Can this issue be waived? Counsel said it cannot.
Oh, I believe it can. It's not a jurisdictional issue. It's only an issue as to whether one part of the sentencing would be imposed concerning the imposition of a fine in these circumstances. It certainly can. I believe the state has waived it on the merits, not only concerning the filing. They never raised that particular issue concerning whether it was or was not filed or complied with the statute. And it seems both the majority and even the dissenting opinion. The dissenting opinion, I think, was referring to the fact that because the court would not accept it and declined to accept it at the time of the sentencing, I, a couple of days later, filed a motion to abate the fine and attach the affidavit again in a filing with the court.
In as much as the statute we're talking about here requires a court to impose a fine.
That's
it's
correct.
It's a mandatory fine. And what the statute then provides is an out. Under certain circumstances, that is the filing of an affidavit of indigency prior to sentencing, filing with the court, as you say, prior to sentencing, under those circumstances, the fine is not, a court may decline to impose the otherwise mandatory fine.
Yes, that's only looking at it as the on a statutory basis, but you also have a constitutional issue, whether you can fine someone or put him in prison possibly for not paying a fine when he is in fact indigent.
I didn't see any constitutional argument in your brief.
Yes,
I
believe I did, Your Honor.
Okay.
I cited the Carr versus Blake case, which that one could not be in prison for non-payment of a fine if the person is indigent.
I mean, you're saying the statute's unconstitutional?
No, I'm saying that you also have the statutory construction, but you also have the overriding constitutional issue, whether you can you know, at some point imprison somebody who is in fact indigent, which is a possibility in the case.
Well, but that wasn't proposed here, was it? I mean, that's sort of, you're arguing about a myth. The judge wasn't saying pay the $1,500.
No, it wasn't, but I'm just saying you also have a constitutional override in considering this particular issue where a person is indisputably indigent at the time of sentencing, and I think...
Well, you would only have that if the judge said, well, since you can't pay your fine, I'm sending you to prison.
Right, but...
But he didn't say that.
No, he didn't, but the fact is that during the period of probation, it is a possibility that the defendant, for not paying the fine, could be subjected to a probation violation hearing. The court could say you're a probation violator, you haven't paid the fine, therefore I'm sending you to prison.
Happens, then we talked about that. That's not a part of this case, is it?
Well, no, but I think when you look at the entire issue in this case, you also have that overview of the constitutional issue about...
So we look at this and decide, well, by imposing this fine, and if the client is unable to pay because he has no funds and no employment, we're going to somehow find a constitutional violation on the assumption that some judge would later violate a long-standing series of constitutional decisions by the United States Supreme Court?
No, I don't believe they even have to reach that issue. All I'm pointing out is that there is that possibility that may arise under the circumstance of this case. I don't think it even have to be reached in this case, because I think very clearly the case has to be decided what is the position, what is the status of the defendant at the time that he is sentenced by the court.
Counsel, you don't make any distinction then the fact that this person is being placed on probation for 4 years. You still contend that indigency must be determined at the date of the hearing, what his financial position is at that time.
Yes, because I believe that's what the statute requires at the time of the sentencing. He may win the lottery 10 years from now, and he may have a lot of money, may inherit money in this case.
But the court can't take any of that into consideration.
No, unless it's, you know, unless there's something there that is going to be the eventuality in the case, which is not in this particular case.
He might even go to work while he's on probation.
Well, yes, that's correct, and hopefully he does, but I would point out, number one, the impediments to working, one, even though this transaction happened on a bicycle, not in a motor vehicle, his driver's license was suspended, so there's some limitation about getting the job, getting to work. There is also the fact that he has very little, doesn't have a complete education, which is another impediment, and probably the most realistic thing, if he does get a job, he would probably get a minimum wage job, barely enough to support him and any dependents he may have, and then you have the added burden of paying a fine. You know, people with sometimes always do not use good judgment, and they have a fine, they don't want to go to jail, and you know, someone may attempt to commit a new crime.
But he was standing in front of the trial judge, who found him to be 6 feet two, 200 pounds, 19 years old, and obviously, as the trial judge said, there ought to be a lot of jobs he can handle. Why shouldn't the court, as Justice Resnick has asked, take that into consideration?
Well, the court can, but the undisputed evidence is that he was indigent at that particular time. He had no job.
And I understand that's your argument. What is your best authority for that? State v. Gutierrez?
Yes, the Gutierrez and the...
And can't Gutierrez be distinguished? Because there, I went back and looked at that, I think it's an 8th District case, as I recall it. In Gutierrez, what happened was he imposed the fine and the jail sentence on somebody known to be indigent.
Well, on that basis, it would be distinguishable because the person was placed in jail. But,
and that didn't happen here.
That did not happen here, but I still think there's really no dispute. The judge impliedly found that this... young man was in fact indigent. He had no job, he had no source of income, he had no assets that he could pay a fine in the case. And the court said, well, basically in the future, well, your circumstances may change. Well, hopefully probation would, you know, assist in his rehabilitation, but I don't think if he is indigent, he should have the added burden of being, you know, assessed a fine and have that to be paid in this case. And I think
counsel, when I was a trial judge, I'd say probably 70% of the people I put on probation were young men between the ages of 18 and 25 who had no job at the time I sentenced them, mostly for drug offenses. You're basically wanting this court to take the position that all of those able-bodied, able-to-work young men should not have to pay the mandatory fine because at that moment they don't have a job. Is that the position you're arguing?
Yes, I believe that's what the statute requires.
What doesn't that give then every defendant the incentive to quit their job right before sentencing, file their affidavit of indigency, and then go out the next day and get a job and they've escaped the fine?
No, I don't believe it does, because in that case, that would be a factual finding that someone took some action to avoid a payment of an obligation that would be upcoming. Certainly, if that were in the record, that so-and-so, Mr. Gibson, a week before the sentencing, had a job, was gainfully employed, and then quit his job to be found indigent, then I think a court would be well-warned in finding.
How easy is that to find out? You ask the guy if he has a job, he says no. I mean, that's usually the extent of the questioning that you do in these hearings. You get 30 of them in an afternoon.
Well, the court is not without help in these cases. There's a prosecutor who can certainly bring these matters to the attention of the court. The state has all sorts of resources. They have a probation report, a probation investigation. The probation investigation did not reveal that he had a job and that he quit it. So there was, you know, there was a lot of work done along those lines to determine whether, in fact, what he was saying at the time of sentencing was accurate. And the court found that it was accurate. The court did not dispute that. The court said later on it's my position that it's at the time of the sentencing and not at some future date that this should be determined.
Isn't his hiring or retaining you privately prima facie evidence of non-indigency?
I don't believe
given how
so.
Much pro bono work you do, I understand.
Well, no, it isn't, because that was, well, number one, it wasn't questioned. Number two, I hadn't even been paid for what
I had
done at that
point. Wait a minute.
Trial
judge did ask you if you've been paid. You said yes.
Well, partially paid, but not by him. I was not paid by him. It was his mother and other members of his family who helped him in the case. As a matter of fact, he even got a free transcript to perfect his appeal in this case. So he certainly did not have the funds to even pay for a transcript of his trial. But, you know, and I don't think when we talk about abuse of discretion, it's not a discretionary thing, because all of the facts were undisputed in this case that this Nathaniel Gibson...
Is he working now?
I really don't know. I couldn't answer. I haven't had any contact.
Or would you? Will you?
I don't believe he's in jail either.
His trial.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mancino. Mr. Saad, you have about 3.5 minutes.
May it please the court. I think I saw the defendant in Monte Carlo last week playing at the casino. Let me not be so facetious. Let me start my comments off by stating that I think the dissenting opinion of Judge Patton is well taken. Judge Patton is looking at a broader picture. Mr. Mancino is looking at a very narrow picture. The Court of Appeals is looking at an even more restrictive picture.
Mr. Sack, may I interrupt? The statute does say, the words of the statute say, if the court finds the defendant that he is indigent. Correct. So it's a present tense verb.
Correct.
But maybe the issue lies in what does indigent mean? How is it defined by the cases? I wonder if the state has researched that issue of what does indigency take in the concept of ability to earn in the future?
Indigency does take the concept of ability to earn in the future. I don't have a case on that. Most of these cases arrive at the arraignment room where the attorneys are present, the defendants are present. For the first time in their lives, they're coming into the criminal justice system, and they're asked a question: do you have funds to afford an attorney? And they sit there, and the judge says, do you have any choses in action, any stock, any gold bullion, anything? And all these questions come out, and they find out whether or not the person is indigent or not. This is a little bit different, Justice Cook. This is a case in which a trial court imposed a fine on a defendant, and he found the defendant not indigent. And 8 days later, Mr. Mancino walks in with an affidavit, and he gives this affidavit to the trial judge and says that my client's indigent. Now, the trial court had the ability to see two great things. He saw, number one, that Mr. Mancino was retained, that he was not on the public assistance. And number two, he knew that the appellate courts that he was also retained. So that's an indicia, and it's prima facie evidence that this man had some type of money.
It really, I mean, it really can't be, because as we know, quite often other folks pay, you know, parents pay council fees. So I don't know if we could really say as lawyers that that would be prima facie.
Well, he didn't claim indigency at the prior start of trial.
That's a whole other thing, isn't it?
That's definite.
Right.
That's definite, Justice. So secondly, the judge then looks up and he sees him to be an able-bodied man, fully capable of working. And he orders him into a restitution of a mere $1,000 or $1,200 or whatever to be payable $200 a month. Now, the question of whether or not he really becomes indigent or not is at the time, let's assume he does not pay down the road. Then there's a probation violation hearing, and the probation officer comes up and says, this man didn't pay the fine. And the judge can then say at that hearing, why didn't you pay the fine? Because I didn't have the money. Then there's another second hearing and another second safeguard. But for this initial purpose, this is not a probation hearing. This judge had the right to order him to pay, make payments for the future. He's able-bodied. Why should the taxpayers bear these costs?
Counsel, doesn't the statute require two things, actually? The filing of the affidavit and the finding, not just that he is indigent, but in the conjunctive, and unable to pay.
Correct.
So
trial judge never made that determination. So we defer to the trial judge's findings.
Isn't unable to pay arguably something different than indigent?
Matter of semantics. I really don't see the difference. Unable to pay is almost equated to indigency. But the judge did not find indigency in this matter. And this is the crux, this is the broad picture that I want to paint a portrait for this court, that you cannot handcuff the trial courts of this community and of this state by reading such a narrow interpretation as to what constitutes indigency or not. Some of these factual patterns have to be left to the trial court in their best determination.
I guess what I'm asking you is, unable to pay, if you're able-bodied and have a future ahead of you,
you're able to pay.
Perhaps the judge is looking at that and saying, you know, I think
correct
time you're going to be able to pay.
Nothing unconstitutional in this matter, like Mr. Mancino tries to make. This is a matter of common sense. It's a matter of public policy that the deadbeats have to pay, that they should not be carried off on the public payrolls forever and ever and ever. This court has got to come up with a determination that this man was not indigent, as the trial court found, and defer to the trial court's findings. Coming up and merely saying, I don't have any money, that's not much of a statement, is it? It really isn't much of a statement to say, I don't have any money and I can't pay. That does not determine indigency in my book, not at all.
Does the fact that it says must be filed before sentencing have any effect at all?
It has a major effect. The question of filing with the court means actual filing. And therefore, since it was not filed until 8 days after, I don't even think that that argument can even be made, because there's no jurisdiction before the court.
So you agree with that portion of Judge Patton's dissent also?
Absolutely.
That the affidavit was never filed?
Absolutely, it was
stamped
never filed.
Stamped by the clerk?
It was never filed.
Stamped by the clerk?
Correct. If you want to reestablish Pless, it's been reestablished by you many times. I'm not going to change your mind on Pless. I'm far too smart for that, Justice Douglas.
You're probably right about that.
I think that's one of the most brilliant decisions around, if you want to add that. All poor Mr. Fry was trying to do was carve a little niche. And I think that door was kind of shut by you, to say the least. As for your one final question I'd like to answer, and that's Justice Cook's
very quickly
remark.
Your red
yes, yes Justice. And that was on the waiver question. The issue of the waiver came up at the Court of Appeals, and since that was the first time under Toledo versus Reasonover at State versus Williams, 51 Ohio State, second, page 112, it was the first time the state had an opportunity to posit that argument. So,
pardon me, what was the answer? That the court of, it came up at the Court of Appeals.
It came up in the Court of Appeals. It came up before the Supreme Court of Ohio. The very first time that the issue of waiver came up was before the Supreme Court of Ohio, when I looked at this thing, and we looked at Judge Patton's dissent. And therefore,
the state did not make the argument
correct
to the panel at the Court of Appeals.
Correct. Correct. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.